Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, brought to you by Money Magazine, creating financial freedom for Australians since 1999.
Welcome everyone to another episode of the Friends with Money podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Baltazar, Editor-in-Chief here at Money Magazine. I'm joined today by Dr. Selena Fisk, a data expert and author of a new book titled I'm Not a Numbers Person. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Well, I have the book right next to me, and I'm so happy that someone's finally written a book titled I'm Not a Numbers Person, because definitely I wish I can say that I have a way with words, but I'm not a numbers person, but, you know, we'll see. So tell us, first of all, thank you for joining us, but I want to know how this book came about.
It's a good question. And the reason it's titled I'm Not a Numbers Person is actually because that's what people say to me all the time. And so when I work with people around the use of numbers, it's really common for people to kind of almost say that numbers are not in their wheelhouse and it's not a skill set that they have. So the reason I started writing this book is I actually used to be a maths teacher. It feels like a bit of a lifetime ago now. And I used to teach maths to high school students. And through my role as a teacher, I started getting into different roles in schools, actually, that looked at student data and student metrics. And we looked at how we could connect those to what we knew about kids and what we knew about teaching and learning and how to improve it. And so over time, I guess I started to write in this space. I started to work more and more. I started to a lot of my own professional learning. And I got to the point where I realized that this idea of using numbers, and I talk a lot about being a data storyteller and needing to tell stories with the data, I realized that that is a far bigger challenge for people across the board, and it's not just limited to schools and student data. So over the last couple of years, I'm now self-employed, and I've started to do a lot more work in the corporate space. And you know, it does surprise me when I get to go and work with industries where I make an assumption that they are numbers people, or they have a large proportion of people who can understand some of the maths and the metrics better than others. And oftentimes there are still lots of people who are struggling. So I guess my book, I hope that my book helps people who are good with numbers, like the technicians. I hope it helps them think about how they talk about numbers to other people. But at the same time, I would like to hope that the people who, for them, when numbers don't come naturally to them, I hope that it gives them a few skills, a bit of a framework, a bit of some language, that, and hopefully some confidence to move forward and use numbers more confidently in their work and life.
Yes. Even the thought of me trying to explain numbers fill me with dread, because I fall in the latter camp of, you know, struggling with numbers, which people might think is surprising. Michelle, you know, you're a finance journalist, surely. And I'm like, well, this is why I'm not an accountant, because I don't want to deal with numbers. So let's talk about numbers in terms of how people understand making decisions around their money or their personal finance. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you've written in this book, which is, what are the different types of data users, and what do you think, where would most people fall under?
I have a quadrant model in the book that has four sections. And so if you can imagine a continuum that's going across the page from left to right. Mm-hmm. The people on the left are the people who don't really take action, or they're doing the same thing with the data, and say in this case with their money, that they've always done. Mm. People on the right-hand side are people who are trying to be responsive, to review what they're doing, to review finances and kind of shift their practice and what's happening, I guess, in their decision-making. We've then, on the vertical axis, so from top to bottom, we then talk about the amount of data that people use. So people at the top are actually using a lot of data to inform that action and evidence, and the people at the bottom are not. So what that kind of means is that we end up with people in one of four quadrants. The one where people are not using any data and they're doing the same thing that they've always done, uh-oh, I call them, yeah, exactly, I say that they're in a stage of stasis. So they're doing the same thing year in, year out. And I spoke with somebody recently who literally takes money out of their bank account every fortnight for petrol
yes.
and puts it in an envelope and they pay in cash. And they've always done it that way. And it's lovely and it feels very wholesome. But it's also, you know, I guess the world has moved on, I would say.
Yeah, so you have the creature of habit. And sometimes if it's a yes. bad habit, especially around money, then you're really missing out, right? So we've got petrol apps that will allow you to kind of save money, for example.
The largest group of people that I meet are people who are, if you're following along with my little quadrant model,
yes.
they're in the area of lost opportunity and they have access to heaps of information, but they're not necessarily acting on it. So, for example, a friend recently, he has a small business, really doing very well. He's very successful. And we know that we can invest money in areas that will get a better return on investment than, for example, sitting money in a transaction account. And he was talking to me about how proud he was about his business. He was doing the same things he's always done. He had been pretty successful. He had $250,000 sitting in his transaction account, which is earning, you know, 0.2% interest per year. So for him, there's a massive lost opportunity there. Because he didn't need access to the money. He could have invested that in something that would have been really financially savvy
that
and would
is
have got
crazy,
some,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's an example of somebody who would be sitting in that quadrant for me. So lost opportunity.
And why is that though? Why is it? Because they don't know. Like, for example, I know that last week ING increase their savings rate to 4%. So if someone's sitting on a transaction at 0.5%, for example, it doesn't make sense that you just don't put your money somewhere that's earning 8 times that.
It's just that people, so say for that person with $250,000 in their transaction account, for them, the 0.5% possible rate versus 4%, that doesn't necessarily mean much to them. It's not in a metric that they understand. And so it's almost they stay in this cycle of doing what they've always done because what he has been doing has been working for him.
Right.
But he's certainly not capitalizing on the different options that are out there. And look, sometimes that's fear. Sometimes
yes.
people trying something new, like I've met people who are worried about interbank transfers, like older people, but people who've said to me, well, I'm worried about transferring this bulk of money to here because what if it gets lost? And so it's difficult because how do you alleviate that fear? And this, the gentleman that I'm talking about, my friend, you know, he's a smart guy. Like it's not that he struggles, you know, he's obviously running a very successful business. But it's just that he's stuck in this thing of always doing the same thing that he's done previously.
And like you said, that's majority of the population because I know a lot of people who are earning a lot of money, but they don't know how to invest it. Like there's so many missed opportunities, whether it's buying a property or buying shares for exactly the same reason. The way they kind of think about numbers is not connected to the decisions they make. I'm not sure.
Yeah. And part of that, I think, is the way that they've grown up. If they've got a perception that they're not a numbers person or that financial literacy is not a strength of theirs, then I think and this is anecdotal, I don't have any data to back this up, but I think those are the people that are less likely to move. Whereas, you know, when I first wanted to get into the share market, I did my own research. I have a background in research, so I knew how to research the best information and I could work out the impact of different interest rates or different returns, say for the share market versus property versus sitting money in an online saver versus a transaction account. I guess that comes more easily to me. And so I think that absolutely plays a part in the fact that I was confident enough to be able to say, okay, well, I'm going to give this a go. And this, my friend that I keep coming back to, I said to him, because he was, as I say, he was telling me how proud he was of his business and he showed me his bank account. And I was like, I'm so proud of you, but we need to move that money. I said, we need to do something with it. And we started talking about shares and The conversation I had with him was he said, look, I've always wanted to get into shares, but I have no idea where to start. So unless somebody's curiosity is such that they start to go and do their own research and their interest is strong enough that they're motivated to, he would keep earning money and sitting it in that account and nothing would change. So yeah, there's a lot to it. It's not as simple as one thing or the other, but there's plenty of people that I see in that lost opportunity quadrant. So people who are buying shares, they're watching the stock market, they're making decisions about selling property. You know, there's a whole stack of people at the moment around my area who are obviously trying to capitalize on the property market. And so there's a lot of properties on the market around my house at the moment. They're taking action based on the fact that they know the market is in a very good position and it's probably going to get worse in the not too distant future. So they're trying to capitalize on that. So they're the people where for them financially, this is the time that they can have an impact, because if they sell now versus 12 or 18 months' time, they're potentially setting themselves up with more profit now than they would in the future. So they're trying to be savvy. It doesn't always work. It doesn't, some things, you know, people who are in this quadrant, they try something out, they invest in something that they've done their research, they've done the hard work, but they, for whatever reason, it doesn't get the returns that they were hoping for or were expecting. And I think that's okay. And that's why we diversify share accounts and that sort of thing, because even with good research and background information, we can still never predict what's going to happen in the future. But that's the goal. So the goal is to get people into that quadrant where they're trying, they're moving money around, they're making good financial decisions, and they're using the evidence and the data to support those decisions.
I'll go back to what you said earlier, which is that most people are fearful about making decisions, even if they are good decisions. And I see that with a lot of fund managers that I interview. What makes them very different to, say, the everyday Australian is not that they're smarter, but I feel like they're a lot more confident about saying, this is the data about this market and these are the predictions, therefore, I will do the action now, I will buy those shares. It is that leap, isn't it, from knowing what you need to do to actually doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's the confidence piece in what you do and what you know. It's confidence in using numbers, but there is that element of courage, isn't there?
Yes.
That it's a leap of faith, really, and putting faith in the process and trusting the process, I guess, that you're investing in.
It's very scary. I still get scared when I think about investing in property or shares. It's like, what if the market crashes tomorrow? Mm. Even if the chances of the market crashing to, say, 80% is impossible, you do think about that. It's in the back of your mind. So what we want to know now is, how can we be better at numbers? Or is this a skill that you can learn over time?
Yeah, look, it absolutely is a skill that you can learn, and we can all get better. And Carol Dweck talks about a growth mindset and, you know, saying that we are maybe not very good with numbers yet, but we can get better at, and our intelligence is not fixed. So we can get better at anything that we put our time and effort into. The reality is that that learning process is a process, it's a journey, and different people will learn at different rates. And part of that is the hurdles, I think, that we've, you know, potentially even got in place from when we're in school. And I know that I'm very comfortable with numbers because my parents were. And so for a lot of people, they've come through school identifying as not being good at maths or being good with words. And, you know, there's almost this kind of starts in, you know, when we start school in prep in year one, where we are either learning English or maths. And so we're either learning the words or we're learning the numbers, and we actually need to be able to combine those two things and think about the narrative and the story that sits that is sitting around the numbers as well. I think for me, one of the things that works for people trying to, I guess, dabble in this for the first time or to learn, even in a workplace, to learn a little bit more, to lean into using numbers a little bit more, is to make a really clear decision about what the metrics are that matter to you. So we have so much different information available.
Yes.
And what matters to me as an individual will be quite different potentially to what you value, Michelle, and quite different to the next person. And so the first thing I think for people to do is to really think, well, for me, what am I interested in and what do I need to know more about? So if, for example, I have credit card, mortgage, personal loans, and I am not really sure what the percentage interest rate actually means for me, I would focus on that one thing and I would go and learn about percentages. And I would go and try and do my own research. There's plenty of really good, quick resources available online to support learning in areas like that. There's plenty of calculators as well. So just staying on that same example of the difference in percentage interest rates, for example, I would encourage you to think about, well, how can I work out what that actually means for me? Because a 20% credit card interest rate, you know, that's kind of a number that sits up here somewhere, up in the cloud somewhere. It doesn't necessarily mean too much to me versus, say, a 4.5% interest rate on my mortgage. Those two percentages themselves don't actually impact me as percentages, if that makes sense. I presented at a real estate conference a little while ago and I had somebody in the audience say to me, he said, oh, my chief financial officer always comes back to me and he said, Selena, I can't, oh, not, he's not me, sorry. He said, I can't spend percentages. I actually want to know about dollars. So what are the metrics that are important to you? What are the things you need to learn more about? How do you go and find some of that information? And then how do you convert it back to something that's tangible and measurable for you? So something that actually kind of works and resonates with you and your situation.
Yes. And you talked about being a maths teacher in a previous life. I must say as well that as a society, maybe we need to stop categorizing people as being good at maths or bad at maths or good at numbers. I mean, really, we shouldn't judge. Like you said, we kind of grow into this person who just needs to learn what we need to learn to save money or be better at managing our finances, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And part of that, I think, also comes to the point that financial literacy is not something that is taught a lot in schools. And I used to use my own personal finance numbers to show my year 11 maths class the difference in interest rates in credit cards, personal loans. I used to talk about my mortgage. And I was really open and transparent about my mortgage repayments and how much I'd borrowed because, to be honest, I felt that it was worth sharing that with a group of 16-year-olds who inevitably needed to go out in the world and work it out for themselves someday. But to be honest, had I not done that, it's not a part of what we do day in, day out. And so, you know, as parents, how do you build financial literacy in your kids? If you're a teenager, how do you go and learn more about and build your financial literacy? And therefore, as adults, if you haven't come through parents who are either teaching you or schools taught you, it kind of makes sense that you're an adult now functioning without a really good understanding of where to go or where to put your money or how to make decisions and therefore potentially lack confidence to do so as well.
Yes, yes. And confidence is incredibly important. One last question before we go, and I want to leave our money listeners with a technical term, and that is you talked about confirmation bias. How can you explain confirmation bias relative to making good money decisions?
Yeah, so confirmation bias is that we often look at or we notice the things that confirm something that we already knew.
Mm.
So, for example, if I wanted to invest in cryptocurrency, a particular cryptocurrency, and I had my heart set on this particular crypto, and I went in and I looked at a graph of the performance of that crypto over time, confirmation bias might do things in my head that make me think, awesome, like this has been trending really well over time, so I'm absolutely going to make money, so I'm going to throw everything at this particular crypto. What it's doing and what your brain does subconsciously is it finds the stuff that confirms what you kind of already wanted to find. So we need to be really conscious of that, because what we then do with confirmation bias is when we find the thing that confirms what we wanted to see, we then start to discount everything else.
Mm.
So when I work with people around trying to mitigate confirmation bias, like we can't get rid of it altogether. It's subconscious. We can't control it. But what we can do is we can flip it a little bit and we can think, what evidence do I have that's actually telling me the opposite truth? So if I see a crypto that has significantly increased, well, actually, have they grown too quickly? And are they about to potentially suffer a massive crash? So not just latching on to that first kind of good news story, but thinking about the other side of it. So yeah, absolutely a factor.
Yes. In our thinking. I can already see that I have an auntie who is anti investing in shares. So when there's a bad news story about shares tanking, she would go, I told you so. You know, this is why I don't invest in shares. And sometimes you have to step back and have a more measured look at, well, you know, you do have to do your own research.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But yes, she feels vindicated.
Yes. Yeah. And it's hard to step back and be objective when you're invested in it, right? Like emotionally invested even in it. It's your money. Being objective is hard.
Well, once again, thank you for joining us. And I must say, I recommend your book, I'm Not a Numbers Person, How to Make Good Decisions in a Data-Rich World. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Michelle.
Well, if you've enjoyed today's podcast, you can help get the word out by leaving a positive review for us on iTunes or on the Apple Podcast app. And don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. Be sure not to miss out on future episodes by subscribing to the Friends with Money podcast on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Once again, you've been listening to the Friends with Money today with Dr. Selena Fisk, and about her book, I'm Not a Numbers Person. I'm Michelle Baltazar, Editor-in-Chief at Money Magazine. Till next time.
Thanks for listening to the Friends with Money podcast. For credible, independent, and easy-to-understand financial commentary, visit moneymag.com.au. Please remember that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are general in nature, and further independent advice and research based on your personal circumstances should be sought before making an investment decision.